All right, Keith, this is down your line. With conventional military weaponry,
oh, no, I'll answer that.
Is it clear what constitutes an act of war, I assume when it comes to the use of a cyber attack? When it comes to, here it is, when it comes to cyber attacks and intrusive actions, let me just interpret myself. What constitutes a cyber act of war?
So this has been a debate, as you know, with both administrations when we were there, both the Bush and the Obama administration. And neither wanted to put a line in the sand because that meant somebody would have to do something. But here's my interpretation, what I gave as an act of war. When a foreign nation uses cyber and their intent is to do something destructive, and they do, whether it's take down Sony or the power grid, that would have equal physical aspects to it, then I believe that's an act of war. Now, it doesn't mean we go to war. It means that's an act of war, and the government, the president and the secretary, now have the option of how do you respond. And there's a whole range of options that they have, from military all the way back to cyber, overt or covert. But I think when countries attack us in cyber, whether they attack the government or the commercial sector, and they destroy data, if it were physical, it would be an act of war. And in cyber, I think it should be the same thing. Now, I would just highlight that we need to fix our defense first. Our defense is terrible, it's inadequate. We have no way of pairing government and industry together, and so the government can't see it. So you walk down that road, and what you find out is, well, it's an act of war, but you can't see that it's an act of war, so you can't respond, so you're doing incident response. Incident response means you lose everything, and then the government comes in and tells you you lost everything. You don't need that. When I talk to CEOs, they say, we'd prefer not to get hacked. Okay. That's pretty good. So if you're going to do that, you're starting to set up this, think of it as an integrated air defense system for cyber. And if you do that, now when a nation state tries to shut down our energy sector, you can see it. We've got to get to that level. We've got to have a vision for cyber that does that. And then when other countries start to probe it, we can send them a warning. Do you really want to do this? I like the happy face on the computer of the president of that country before you destroy his computer. And you say, you know, don't mess with us. Oh, that's Texas, but you know, you get it.
Any thoughts about what constitutes an act of war?
Well, he and I agree because we had the same conversation. Well, I only dealt with the Obama administration about the same things, in fact, the Sony thing specifically. But what I would say is, from the other side of it, it's very difficult because when the incident is occurring, you can't know who's perpetrating it. You know, you can go and ask. You ask people that you might know, friends, and they might be able to assist you. But as General said, it's after the fact. And because we don't have a data sharing regime that the two of us have tried very, hard to get into place, and hopefully some new legislation might do that, you really don't have a unified response mechanism in the United States today. So as a company, it's after the fact, you figure out who did it, there's nothing you can really do but restore yourself to last known good. So what we have been advocating, and I feel very strongly that we have just missed on, is this ability to share information about threats and incoming threats, even blinded. You don't have to know, you know, from what company. You can opt in a blind way into this information sharing and be able to do some preventative, you know, and share information. And I think that's important for us.
Keith, if our intelligence agencies told us that, for example, Russia was going to conduct a cyber attack on our electric grid, or that Iran was going to conduct a cyber attack on our electric grid, do we have the capability to go after them and stop them from doing that?
Yes.
What? We're treading close to classified information.
Yeah, so I think the hard part, yes, I think we could stop them. It was a great opportunity serving at NSA and Cyber Command in our military. We have great people, and I think we're the best in the world. The real problem that our government has is the government can't see all that hitting our private sector.
That's exactly
because we don't have the information sharing, and that's what Renee was saying. So if you put that together, you'd say, look, there are things critical to the operation continuity of government for this nation. Right. Energy, finance, healthcare, telecommunications, some other parts of government. Some of them we could let them shut down. We'll pick those later. But if you think about it and you say everybody agrees to that, then the next thing you'd say is, so how do you see that data that's hitting them? And the answer is, well, we don't share, or we share it by, emails go at the speed of light. We want to share data today by writing it out, having somebody look at it, sending it to a lawyer, seeing if it's okay, and then sending it down. Think if we did our missile defense program like that, right? Everybody would say, that's crazy. But that's how we do cyber. Sharing, and that's just in the private sector.
Yeah.
And so we have to fix that. And I believe we're in part doing that, and that's one of the things Congress is looking at. But you got to take the next step, and then we need to do it.
Let me ask you along those lines. How vulnerable is the United States to a cyber Pearl Harbor? In other words, a cyber attack that could literally paralyze our country. And what kind of virus are we talking about? How would it be deployed? And what would be the targets?
So I think we and other countries are vulnerable. I think we have more to lose than anybody else. Not just our intellectual property, but our whole nation is, connected to the networks. And I was in the Ukraine last week, and while I was there, I didn't do this, I'm just reporting what I heard, just let's get this part. But Russian intelligence had infected 500,000 routers worldwide. Most of them in the Ukraine. With that capability, not only could they steal credentials and other things, but they could shut down communications within that country. Shut it down. We could suffer the same kinds of attacks. And my experience, CEOs, especially in energy and finance, are really pushing to get this fixed. They really are. But we're at risk. And the biggest risk we have is not that they're not trying to do their part, it's that they can't talk to government and there's nobody to shoot back. And so think about somebody launching missiles at you and they're saying they're shooting over there, and then you just say, well, where's our shooters? They don't have rules of engagement and they can't see the fire. So they can't shoot back. And it would only be by luck or by going back over time to do that. And as we noted earlier, that's crazy because that means everybody's lost and now we enter in. So I do think we're at risk today because we haven't put all that in place and we need to go fix that.
Renee, when you look at, obviously there are a lot more attacks to the private sector going on. But in addition to that, when you look at our infrastructure, the government doesn't really control the infrastructure.
No.
These are companies, that are out there that that are controlling it. How do we make sure that those companies can effectively defend against the kind of sophisticated cyber attacks we're talking about?
Well, this is actually all part of the same conversation. Today, those companies do an excellent job. They all, work very hard. Every major, company in every sector is really deploying as much as they can to defend. Everyone's getting, and I should say, I know we're focused on critical infrastructure and, what could you take down, but the reality is one of the biggest things that's going on is really economic warfare through cyber, which is break in and steal intellectual property and actually trade secret, the know-how. which is one of the, you know, the most elusive things that some of our competitive nation states have not been able to get. They can actually get the technology, but they can't figure out the know-how, which is the how to employ it, how to use it, how to make it work. And that is, you know, so these cyber attacks aren't just let's disrupt the United States power grid, which is an issue in itself. It's actually get into these companies and figure out how to exfiltrate information, intellectual property, and trade secret. So the infrastructure companies do a great job, but it's all part of the same issue. In fact, the infrastructure companies are part of the committee that I'm the chair of, where we, you know, have been having this dialogue. We used to have it with the general. We have it with his next person who's running that department. You have to be able to share information. And we aren't in a place legislatively and or physically, you know, the right configuration to do that. So they're on their own. They're very good at it. But after the fact, there's a big discussion, oh, this happened, did you see that? So what's happened is ad hoc. Many of us, and when I was at Intel, and now even in my current role at my new company, we have an informal network where all the CISOs call each other. And or some of the CEOs call each other. Have you seen this? Have you seen that? And I heard this from so-and-so. This is the greatest way that people get information and, you know, prepare themselves. We got hit with this. You guys better get ready. It's not perfect, but it's what we're doing right now.
So there's a real problem with the private sector sharing the information. I mean,
liability part.
I mean, well, what you're saying is that we really need a public-private partnership to effectively defend this country.
That's right.
From those kinds of attacks. But the problem is that there isn't that sharing of information.
It's worse.
It's not just that
they can't share, it's the mechanisms that we think about sharing today are ineffective for accomplishing the job
right.
that you want to do. We want, right now, you know, it was interesting when I got Cyber Command, we got Cyber Command given to me because we stopped an attack on the Defense Department, a big one, NSA did. And the issue when I went and talked to, after we got this job, we said, well, what happened? And everybody started talking and it sounded like Johnny Depp. Nope, you know, what? Nobody understood. And the reason, and the reason is, you know, we fight blind in cyberspace. You can't see it. Ask somebody to explain to you how the attack went. And when you listen to it, what you find out is they don't have a clue. They know, well, I got this piece, and then somebody comes in and said, this piece of malware got in here and got it. And, you know, and think about fighting a military campaign where everybody's blindfolded, and you have no sensors, and people are shooting at you, and you say, what's going on? And more importantly, you're not networked together. You're all fighting by yourselves. Because that's
and
how
you
we
can't
fight
share
today.
With the people
yeah,
in the
so
store.
There, in this, so think about this. Every energy company out there fights and defends itself.
That's right.
Every finance company, but they share data, but the amount and time they share it, it's meaningless.
Yeah.
This is going at network speed. Imagine now, if you will, a network that oversees all of that, that shares only the malware, not personally identifiable information. Here's what's trying to probe you. Here's what's going on. That's visible to those companies and to the government. That's where we need to be. And in that manner, you can then see, Iran is trying to hit our finance sector. Well, they did that, right? And we couldn't see it. And so the decision makers did not understand the impact of those attacks. Because they couldn't see it. And they said, well, you're being attacked. You should fix that yourself. It's a good thing it wasn't a motorized rifle regiment.
Yeah, no, exactly. Talking about attacks, this next question deals with the 2016 attack on our election. What actions have the federal government and states taken to prevent a repeat during the midterm elections? We know obviously that what the Russians did in 2016. The intelligence agencies tell us that the Russians are continuing to do that. do we have an effective mechanism at the federal and state level to try to prevent that from happening?
Absolutely not.
I can see it.
And the reason, there's several aspects of this, and it was interesting. I was in the Ukraine last week, as I mentioned earlier, and this was one of the big issues. And you look at there, Russia is using what's called hybrid warfare in their terms to do information campaigns and cyber attacks and all of these things to impact the outcome of the election more favorable to Russia. And, you know, it's interesting, from creating a false story, which they did here. They created a white group and a black group, created on Facebook. These were both created by Russians in St. Petersburg. And then in the US, over 10,000 people joined each of these groups, and then they tried to get them to fight each other. And it actually, they got it going, and you know, and they were all the people in these groups said, no, no, this is a real group, we're doing this, and it was all set up in cyber. And we don't see that. So when you think about that, it's inadequate. That's the first part. Influencing the outcome of a campaign is what they're trying to do. And I think one of the ways that we ought to get out in front of this, the Ukrainian presidential elections will come in March of next year. We ought to be all over that, seeing what Russia is doing and making sure we're in front of that and do the best we can, because ours will follow. And we've got to get this right, and it's not where it needs to be. And I think Renee and I will agree on this point, is that, you know, it's completely inadequate. And the Russians, you know, if you leave this out there for them to go after, or any of our adversaries, they're going to go after it. It's in their national interest. And so if you don't like it, fix the defense.
Well, I think one of the complexities in this situation is part of the defense is social networks. And, you know, on the cyber side, we might be able to do a better job of tightening up the defense. But on the social networking and the social engineering side, I think it's quite difficult. And we have to, you know, rely on, this is back to part of our, one of our challenges that's different than the people that we have as adversaries, is we have a, you know, open, democratic, you know, free market system, which doesn't allow, you know, currently we don't have this concept of a ring of defense that's somehow nationalized, even though they're supposedly independent companies, right? So it's very difficult to say, okay, now everybody, you better seek out and find anything that might look suspicious, that's, you know, maybe social engineering the outcome, because now we're saying to the Facebooks and the Googles and the, you know, can you go do that piece of work for us, right? Because, I mean, the government doesn't have the ability to manage social networks. That's not part of how we operate here in the United States.
So, right? So what you're saying is that you basically place false stories.
Yeah, the social engineering aspect is huge.
And put that into the social media world, and that stuff then spreads by itself.
I think that the way that we are so connected by social networks, and I don't mean just Facebook, I mean, you know, WeChat and WhatsApp and, you know, all of this, is that I think we have to this is one of the things I think we have to start educating people on. Not, remember when people used to say to you, not everything you read is true, you know, not everything they put in the paper is true. Yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah. Like, nobody seems to be able to tell what's true and what's not true. This is a very big deal, because at the basis of that is all of these different social engineering techniques, which is, you know, the most obvious example of it has been the Russian interference in the election, but there's lots of others that we just haven't had in the dialogue yet. So I do think that there's a piece of work that we need to do to figure out how we're going to deal with this issue in social networks and, you know, for lack of a better term, fake news.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that came out is France, having seen what happened in our election, said, what we'll do is, we know we're going to get hacked by Russia, and we know when they hack our stuff, they'll throw it out into the network. So what we'll do is put some crazy stuff into our data that we know is absolutely stupid. So when they pour it out there, we'll say, look, that's crazy. You know that can't be right, and this is this. And they did that, and they actually were able to do that. So I think we've got to come up with a way, and it's interesting talking to some of the folks from Google and these other social media, they are coming up with ways to detect fake videos and other things like
that's
that.
Right.
So we've got to just take that the next step. And you know, the good part, we got some great talent out there. And I think, you know, Zuckerberg has had, you know, his first, you know, welcome to Congress meeting.
Welcome, and welcome to the world.
Yeah, and then even worse to EU. So I think what they're going to do is go back and say, how do we fix this? How do we tighten it up? And I think we'll come up with some good ideas on. But defending the nation is still out there.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Do you think we should design fully automated military systems, or should humans always retain veto power?
I think humans should always retain veto power.
I do too.
And I think that, you know, it's interesting. I'm a tech guy. I'm not a historian. But if you go back to Clausewitz, what those that wish us harm, they want to impact your will to fight, our nation, national will. And so they're going to use all devices that they can. It's not machine on machine. It's to impact our population, us as a country. And that will always be the target. So while machines can fight parts of the war, the impact is on our population, our people. And I think we can't lose sight of that. And it's interesting, I was in an armory unit, volunteered to be in an armory unit whenever it says there's no longer need for armor, and we won't need armor, and there was no need for this. And that was 1990, just going into the first Desert Storm. So I do think, that's what I think on that.
Well, but the problem now is we've got 50 nations that have developed some kind of robotic military operations. And, you know, they're obviously all buying drones, but they're also interested in robotic soldiers and military. That many nations, including Russia and Iran, China and others, that are doing that, you know, we may say humans ought to be in charge, but once you develop that kind of robotic warfare, particularly in other countries, are they really going to care whether humans are in charge or whether those robots are accomplishing the military mission that they were assigned? I mean, that's a real problem in terms of, you know, of how do we gain controls over that? Because in many ways, it's similar to nuclear weapons. How do we, we tried to grab some control over nuclear weapons.
We're going to have to do the same thing. I mean, we're going to end up back in the restatement of a whole bunch of norms around the rules of engagement. And, you know, maybe we'll revitalize the role of the United Nations and what it's really supposed to be doing. I mean, we have to do something. Yeah. You can't be a free-for-all. That's not going to work because, you know, what ends up happening, humans train the machine. And one of the things that is important in all of this is the ethics with which people decide to train. And so we have a point of view, our values, as Keith would say, that we will train into whatever robotic or, you know, AI systems that we have. They may not be shared by other people, right? They have different values with which they train. So I do think that we're going to fall back to, you know, having to have global norms and some controls around the rules of engagement in these things. And it's not a moment too soon to start that. I mean, if we were really thinking forward, we would say, okay, we should get ahead of this use of drones. We should use drones as an example, tip of the spear, of how and when is it appropriate to use drones, and do we use it under the same rules of engagement and that kind of thing, and who controls it, and do you have to go and, you know, the allies, people have to go and agree on it, that kind of thing. I think we better get ahead of it. I don't think we should just let it go organic.
Yeah, and I would just add to all that this is an area that machine, AI, faster computing is going to win.
Yeah.
And it's this decision loop.
Yeah.
And that's one of the main reasons we have to lead the AI and computer race.
Keith, what is the NSA doing that it shouldn't be doing? And what isn't it doing that it should be doing?
Don't notice these television cameras in any way.
So I think it's a great question because it allows me to say, you know, it's kind of interesting. First, NSA operates under our U.S. Constitution. So as the director, I had more oversight than elementary school kid that had been to the principal's office a lot. And it's by Congress, the courts, and the administration. The NSA is not authorized to go out and collect information unless you have all those approvals. And then, ironically, it was targeted on terrorists, not US people. So targeting, and the Zazi case is a great one, where they targeted overseas communication, Al-Qaeda talking to somebody in the US and found a bomb plot trying to blow up the New York City subway. That's what we want NSA to do. I think what this, the Snowden and all this has done, is made NSA more skittish and put our country at risk in this area at a time when we can't afford that risk. And most importantly, I think many good people are leaving. You know, most of those people are paid a government salary. And I can now tell you, being on the outside, they get paid less than we do. And we want them, we want the best and the brightest to help keep this country safe. So I think that's the key thing. What should they be doing? Well, I would extend that to say, as we look at cyber, how do they help in the cyber and take the next step? And I think their engagement in many of these discussions is going to be key.
In your opinion, where does the U.S. stand in the competition to develop artificial intelligence? Are we devoting enough resources to this effort? Renee?
Are we devoting enough resources? No, I don't think we are. I think we're devoting a lot of resources on commercial implementation of machine learning and natural language, but a focused national-wide effort to make sure that we're the leaders in AI technology, I don't think has really come to fruition. So until we're doing that, because it's a building block technology to, as Keith said, it's a building block technology to the next superpower or to maintain yourself as a superpower in combination with other technologies. I think until we have a nationalized, focused effort that includes academia and the government and private industry, I think we are not where we need to be. And that is what the Chinese have. And they've already said that they're going to make it, one of their top priorities, and they expect to be the leaders by a date that they've put out there. They said how much they're willing to spend on it, and I think that's that we should take that very seriously.
So, Keith, I agree, and I would add to that right now we lack a coherent national effort in this area.
That's right.
And if you think about it, we have a lot of great companies out there that are coming up with artificial intelligence rules around, which I think are great. China is being led in a coherent effort by their government and a lot of money in Russia and in Europe. We should do the same if we agree that this is critical to our national future, which I believe it is. If we say that, I'm not saying take over from industry. I'm saying reinforce that, double down, make that a national initiative, and work with private industry to see how we can help be the leaders in this area. It's interesting because if you think about both AI and quantum computing, many believe that quantum computing will create a new era of computing like what happened in the mid-80s. And think about how that helped our country and all these great companies that have sprung up since the mid-1980s, Microsoft, all on. And so with quantum, there could be another whole group of those. We need to lead in that area, and we're not. So I think we should put a national initiative. There should be a classified and unclassified portion, and we should drive this like we did the Manhattan Project, but not have it in Manhattan.
How can the United States defend against countries which have little distinction between industry and government and engage in industrial espionage? Obviously, let's put China at the top of that list. And answer this question, but also, if you could, recently ZTE, which is a Chinese operation that was accused of espionage, and sanctions were placed against it. And the president then decided, I guess based on a call with President Xi, to try to rehabilitate ZTE and try to help Chinese workers. But Congress is obviously opposed to this because of the concern about espionage. What's the story on ZTE, and do the Chinese, I mean, you've talked about this transfer of wealth. How do the Chinese operate in this country with regards to ZTEs and Huawei and others?
Look at the time. Okay, so first, Huawei and ZTE, it's interesting, and many of you know this story, but for those of you who don't, Huawei was created by a third PLA person. Think of
Chinese government.
Chinese government, Intel. And using stolen information from Cisco.
Right.
And then mass producing that at a price that Cisco couldn't compete at. Mm-hmm. Similar for ZTE. So think about, they have 1.3 billion people. You can mass produce routers and other capabilities at a price that we can't compete with. And it's stolen, information from us. So two things. One, we've got to protect our intellectual property from them. And two, we've got to fix our defense. Our defense is, we have left this out in the open. And part of that defense isn't depending on companies to try to defend themselves against nation states, which in this case is what we're doing. We wouldn't say to Sony, protect yourself from an armed force from Russia. If they come down the West Coast, good luck. Build an army. We don't. We developed this government for the common defense. That includes cyber. So we've got to fix that. Now, where their government and their industry come together, I actually think ours not having them together is an advantage. It's an innovation advantage. And so the way we beat them, we out-innovate them, but we've got to protect that intellectual property that we're innovating, and we're not doing that today.
Do you see it in Silicon Valley, the Chinese making that kind of effort?
All of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a constant, ever-vigilant situation. I think it's a little bit more complicated. Chinese consumption of tech is more than half the market in most segments. And the number one import, we've been talking a lot about the other balance, their view on the imbalance is their number one import into China is semiconductors. So their view is, hey, wait a minute, we're really, and that is the core building block for all of these other industries. And so I think there's more to this. I think it's more complicated. I don't think we want to link them because of the innovation issue. I don't think that we want to have necessarily a economic industrial policy per se, but I do think we need to be more clever. I think we're going to have to actually ooch further towards some kind of industrial policy that says we're going to collaborate and we're going to be smarter than that. We're going to not only out-innovate, but we're going to protect. Most of the cyber, I already said this earlier in the evening, most of the cyber intrusions are oriented towards the theft of IP and know-how. Many of them are resident in the network for a long time. They are also coordinated with human intelligence, the placement of employees into the business, so that when the cyber is activated, whether it's a day, a week, or several years later in the network, the human employee with the data, that collaboration results in pretty good information and ability to use the data. And we see it everywhere. We see it in every single business, every single industry, and it's pretty much, one of the top things that you're protecting against. You're not protecting against necessarily, some people are protecting against credit cards and that kind of thing, depending on what business you're in. But if you are a major innovator, like a Cisco or an Oracle or an Intel or whomever, that's what you're protecting against, the theft of IP. So the ZTE thing, I noticed that the general didn't answer that part, but it's complicated. But what do they build? What is the thing they build? 5G chips. The thing we think is the next thing for the United States that we're gonna be leaders in. we're going to deploy it the fastest of anyone in the world. So Huawei, that one genie's out of the bottle, because 40% of the networks in the entire world, except for the United States, use Huawei. So everybody else's network's running Huawei in Europe and in, you know, Asia and every place else. So now all of a sudden we have the ZTE thing. So I don't know the answer, but I don't understand it. Because all of a sudden, we're going to be the fastest country in the world to deploy 5G with what? Our own chips? Or so I don't understand it. I think it's very, very unique.
So that's a very nice way to say it. We're coming to the end here, and I just want to ask about this reliance that we have on the internet, from everything from power to banking and commerce, communications, defense. Can we agree that the internet is too big to fail, or should we be taking steps to try to decrease our level of dependence, or is it too late?
Too late. Technology never goes backward. Remember that. That's a rule. I mean, that's like the thing, right? You can't put it back. So you got to make it better. I mean, you either have to have a network that's more secure, you have to have overlay networks that are more secure, you have to do things to it, but you can't take it back.
And you can, this is doable. The issue is,
technology exists.
I think we need a national vision that incorporates not only how we secure the network, but also on these key technologies, how we ensure our leadership. This is a competition, an economic competition for the future. Yeah. And
it's
it
like
impacts
the race
our
to space.
National.
I mean, it really is. It's that. I mean, I think I don't want to. It is not overstating it to say this is like the race to the moon.
Yeah.
I mean, and it is that level of coordination. You know, when everybody was on board with that, it was a government initiative, but it took a lot of private industry to get to the moon.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've had two people who are probably the best, one of the best group of experts on this whole issue. This evening. On the American dream, obviously we need protection here, but I think the key, as we found out these last few lectures, the real key rests with all of you and the importance of protecting our democracy. If we protect our democracy, I think we can protect the American dream. Thank you very much.